Robert's Rules of Order has been called the Bible of parliamentary procedure for good reason. Since its first publication in 1876 by Henry Martin Robert, a retired Army Brigadier General, this guidebook has transformed millions of potentially chaotic meetings into models of efficiency and fairness. What began as Robert's attempt to create a brief pamphlet grew into a comprehensive system used by organizations worldwide. Today, celebrities like Oprah Winfrey credit parliamentary procedure with helping run their business meetings effectively, while major corporations, nonprofits, and government bodies rely on these rules to maintain order. The cultural impact is so significant that "I move to" and "point of order" have entered everyday language, even appearing in films and television shows depicting organizational meetings. At its core, Robert's Rules addresses a fundamental human challenge. How can groups make fair decisions when opinions differ and emotions run high? Have you ever sat through a meeting where everyone talked at once, decisions seemed arbitrary, or a vocal minority dominated the discussion? This chaos is exactly what parliamentary procedure aims to prevent. As groups grow beyond 3 to 4 people, the need for formal structure becomes essential. By the time a group reaches 12-15 members, without proper rules, meetings can devolve into frustrating free-for-alls where little gets accomplished. Parliamentary procedure evolved from centuries of practical experience, starting with ancient Greek assemblies, but primarily developing through the English Parliament's practices. What makes these rules valuable isn't their historical pedigree, but their practical effectiveness in helping groups reach fair decisions efficiently, whether in harmony or bitter contention. The beauty of parliamentary procedure lies in its balance between majority rule and minority rights. While the majority ultimately decides, proper procedure ensures everyone has the opportunity to be heard. When widely understood and properly implemented, these rules transform chaotic gatherings into productive sessions where decisions reflect the group's genuine will rather than who speaks loudest or most forcefully. Think of parliamentary procedure as the operating system for group decision-making. Just as you wouldn't wait until your computer crashes to install an operating system, groups shouldn't wait until conflict erupts to implement proper meeting procedures. When followed as a matter of course, these rules create a framework where disagreements can be expressed and resolved constructively, without personal attacks or procedural manipulation. The 80-20 principle applies perfectly here. Mastering about 20% of the rules will handle 80% of situations you'll encounter in typical meetings. This core knowledge empowers any group to conduct business efficiently while protecting the rights of all participants. Contrary to what some might think, structure in meetings doesn't limit freedom, it creates it. A well-structured meeting follows a predictable pattern that allows participants to focus on content rather than process. This structure begins with the presiding officer, called the chair while presiding, calling the meeting to order and continues through a logical sequence of activities. The quorum requirement, typically a majority of members, serves as a crucial safeguard against unrepresentative decision-making. Without a quorum, substantive business cannot proceed, preventing small factions from making decisions that should involve the full membership. This protection is so fundamental that any substantive action taken without a quorum is considered invalid. The standard order of business provides a roadmap for meetings, beginning with reading and approval of minutes, moving through reports from officers and committees, addressing unfinished business from previous meetings, and concluding with new business. This sequence isn't arbitrary. It ensures that ongoing matters receive proper attention before new topics are introduced. A common misconception worth correcting, there's no such thing as old business in proper procedure. The correct term is unfinished business, which specifically refers to matters previously introduced but not completed. When a chair asks for old business, they're actually using incorrect terminology that can create confusion about what belongs in this category. For more complex meetings, a formal agenda may replace the standard order, listing specific items in sequence and sometimes assigning time limits. Regardless of which approach is used, the structure serves the same purpose, ensuring that business proceeds in a logical, predictable manner that respects everyone's time and the organization's priorities. The meeting concludes with adjournment, which requires a vote if business remains unfinished. For brief pauses during a meeting, the group may vote to recess for a specified time, or the chair may direct members to stand at ease until called back to order, a less formal pause that doesn't require a vote. This structured approach might initially seem overly formal, but its value becomes apparent when contentious issues arise or when meetings involve numerous participants with competing priorities. In those moments, having established procedures prevents confusion and ensures fairness. The heart of parliamentary procedure is the motion, a formal proposal that the group takes specific action. This process transforms individual ideas into collective decisions through a structured sequence that ensures clarity and fairness. When you want to propose action, you must first obtain the floor by standing after the previous speaker finishes and addressing the chair, Madam President, Mr. Chairman. Once recognized, you have the exclusive right to speak until you yield the floor by sitting down. This orderly process prevents multiple people from speaking simultaneously and ensures everyone has an opportunity to be heard. To make a motion, simply state, "I move that," followed by your proposal in clear, precise language. The exact wording matters because the group will vote on these specific words, not a vague concept. For complex motions, writing them down beforehand helps ensure clarity and provides the secretary with an accurate record. For a motion to be considered, it must be seconded by another member, showing that at least two people want the matter discussed. A second doesn't necessarily indicate agreement with the motion, just that it deserves consideration. Without a second, the motion isn't put before the group. After a motion is moved and seconded, the chair states the question by repeating the exact motion. This critical step ensures everyone understands what's being proposed and marks the point when the motion officially belongs to the assembly. Once stated by the chair, the motion is pending, or on the floor, and ready for debate. Debate focuses solely on the merits of the proposal, whether it should be adopted. The chair typically recognizes the motion's maker first, then alternates between supporters and opponents. During debate, members may also introduce secondary motions that modify the main motion, like amendments, or affect its consideration, like postponement. When debate appears complete, the chair puts the question by restating the motion and calling for votes in favor and opposed. After voting concludes, the chair announces the result in three parts: which side has it, whether the motion passed or failed, and what happens as a result. This structured process might seem unnecessarily formal for simple decisions, but it becomes invaluable when addressing complex or controversial matters. By separating the stages of proposal, discussion, and decision, the motion process allows groups to methodically work through issues while maintaining order and respect. Effective debate is the cornerstone of good decision-making in meetings. Unlike casual conversation or heated arguments, formal debate follows specific rules designed to focus discussion on issues rather than personalities, ensuring all perspectives are heard while maintaining decorum. In standard procedure, each member may speak twice on any debatable motion on the same day for up to 10 minutes each time. These limits prevent domination by a few voices and ensure meetings progress efficiently. Unlike congressional procedures, parliamentary rules don't allow yielding the floor to let someone else speak during your allotted time. Each speaker must be recognized independently by the chair. The chair plays a crucial role in managing debate fairly. While generally recognizing the first person to seek the floor after the previous speaker finishes, three important exceptions exist. The maker of a motion has first right to speak on it, someone who hasn't spoken yet has preference over those who have, and the chair should alternate between supporters and opponents when possible. These principles ensure balanced discussion rather than allowing one side to monopolize the conversation. Perhaps the most important debate rule is focusing on issues rather than personalities. You may vigorously attack an idea, but must never attack the person proposing it. Terms like fraud, liar, or lie about other members are strictly forbidden. This isn't merely about politeness. Personal attacks intimidate participation and create lasting animosity that damages organizational effectiveness. To maintain this focus on issues, certain formalities are observed. You speak as though addressing the chair rather than directly to other members. Even when asking questions of another person, you do this through the chair. Members are referred to by their titles or as the previous speaker rather than by name. These practices might seem artificial, but they create psychological distance that helps prevent debate from becoming personal. Not all motions are debatable. Main motions and some secondary motions, like amendments, can be debated, while others, like adjournment or the previous question, cannot. This distinction helps meetings progress efficiently by limiting discussion to substantive matters while handling procedural issues promptly. When debate becomes excessive, a two-thirds vote can limit it by restricting speaking time or the number of speeches. Conversely, limits can be extended when more thorough discussion is warranted. The motion for the previous question immediately closes debate and requires a two-thirds vote, a higher threshold because cutting off discussion infringes on members' rights to be heard. Mastering these debate principles transforms meetings from frustrating experiences into productive exchanges where diverse perspectives contribute to better decisions. When members focus on issues rather than personalities, even contentious topics can be addressed constructively. Few proposals emerge perfectly formed. The amendment process allows groups to refine motions by modifying their wording and, within limits, their meaning. This collaborative refinement often produces better outcomes than the original proposal. Amendments must specify exactly where in the motion the change should be made and precisely what words to use. Think of amendments as giving word-by-word editing instructions to the secretary. They come in three basic types: inserting words, striking out words, or a combination of both, striking out and inserting. When an amendment is proposed, the chair ensures clarity by stating both the amendment itself and how the main motion would read if amended. This helps members understand exactly what they're voting on. After debate, the group votes on the amendment, not on the main motion itself. If the amendment passes, discussion returns to the main motion as amended. If it fails, discussion continues on the original motion. For example, if a motion proposes establishing a division open to juniors and seniors enrolled in city high schools, an amendment might insert "and suburban county" before high schools to expand eligibility. Another amendment might strike "juniors and" to limit participation to seniors only. Beyond simple word changes, amendments can also modify entire paragraphs through insertion, deletion, or substitution. A substitute amendment replaces an entire paragraph or section with different text, offering an alternative approach to the same issue. To prevent confusion, amendments can only be amended once. There are no third-degree amendments. If you dislike a pending amendment, a simpler approach is often to explain why members should vote it down so you can offer a better alternative. Two important rules govern what amendments are permitted. First, amendments must be germane. They must involve the same question as the motion they amend. For example, if discussing establishing a tennis league division, an amendment opposing city tax increases would be ruled out of order as not germane. Second, once a group has voted on a specific amendment, that matter is considered settled. You cannot propose substantially the same amendment again during that meeting. However, you might propose a broader amendment that changes both previously amended text and additional text. The amendment process exemplifies how parliamentary procedure balances efficiency with thorough consideration. By allowing refinement of proposals while maintaining clear rules about what changes are permitted, the process helps groups reach decisions that reflect their collective wisdom rather than just the initial proposal. Sometimes the best decision is to delay making a decision. Parliamentary procedure offers several tools for managing the timing of decisions and ensuring matters receive proper consideration. When a group needs more time before voting on a motion, the motion to postpone to a certain time allows delaying consideration until a specific time or meeting. This requires only a majority vote and can be amended to change the postponement time. While debating postponement, discussion must focus solely on whether postponement is wise and for how long, not on the merits of the main motion itself. Generally, you cannot postpone beyond the next regular meeting and never beyond 3 months. When a motion needs redrafting or further study, the motion to commit or refer sends it to a committee. This majority vote motion should specify which committee will handle the matter and may include instructions about when to report back or what changes to consider. Again, debate must focus only on whether referral is appropriate, not on the main motion's merits. Committees come in two varieties: standing committees with continuing existence and responsibility for particular subject matters, and special committees created for specific tasks that dissolve once their purpose is fulfilled. Standing committee members are typically appointed by the president or elected by the group, while special committee members may be named in the creating motion or appointed by the presiding officer. These tools for managing the flow of business reflect parliamentary procedure's practical wisdom. Not every proposal is ready for immediate decision, and forcing premature votes often leads to poor outcomes. By providing structured methods to delay consideration or delegate detailed work to smaller groups, these rules help organizations make better informed decisions while using meeting time efficiently. The motion to postpone is particularly useful when additional information will become available later, or when members need time to consider implications. Committee referral works best for matters requiring detailed analysis or redrafting that would be impractical during a full meeting. Both approaches recognize that good decisions often require time and careful consideration. Rather than rushing to judgment or allowing matters to remain perpetually unresolved, these procedures provide clear pathways for addressing issues when the group is better prepared to decide. Even the most careful deliberations sometimes lead to decisions that later prove unwise or incomplete. Parliamentary procedure balances stability with flexibility by establishing specific methods for reconsidering decisions when necessary. To prevent endless re-voting on the same issue, once a motion has been disposed of at a meeting, another motion raising the same question generally can't be brought up again at that same meeting. Additionally, changing a previous action typically requires greater support than was needed for the original action. However, special procedures exist for those occasions when a group realizes it made a mistake. If a motion has been adopted or defeated during a meeting, only a member who voted on the winning side can move to reconsider it. This makes sense. If nobody who supported the winning position has changed their mind, the outcome likely wouldn't change. The motion to reconsider must typically be made on the same day as the original vote. If adopted by majority vote, it brings the original motion back before the assembly exactly as it was before the first vote. When it's too late to reconsider, after a meeting ends, you can still change previous decisions through two related motions. The motion to rescind completely cancels a previous action, while amend something previously adopted modifies it. Anyone can make these motions regardless of how they voted originally, and there's no time limit. Without previous notice, these require either a two-thirds vote or a majority of the entire membership. With previous notice, announced at the prior meeting or included in the meeting call, only a simple majority is needed. If a motion is defeated and you want to try again, you cannot simply remake the same motion during the same meeting. However, after the meeting ends, you can propose the identical motion at your next meeting. This renewal of a defeated motion can be done regardless of how you voted originally. These procedures reflect the practical reality that circumstances change, new information emerges, and groups sometimes make mistakes. By providing structured methods to revisit decisions while setting appropriate thresholds for changes, parliamentary procedure helps organizations remain responsive without sacrificing stability. The higher vote requirements for changing previous decisions without notice serve an important purpose. They protect absent members from having decisions reversed without warning. When members receive advance notice that reconsideration is planned, they can attend and participate in that decision, which is why the vote threshold is lower in such cases. Voting is the fundamental way groups make decisions, with different methods and requirements appropriate for different situations. Understanding these variations helps ensure that voting accurately reflects the Assembly's will. Most decisions require a simple majority vote, more than half of the votes cast, excluding abstentions. Only those who actually vote count toward the total. For example, if 10 members are present but only 7 vote, with 4 in favor and 3 against, the motion passes, since 4 is a majority of the 7 votes cast. Unlike plurality voting used in political elections, parliamentary procedure requires a true majority, meaning elections may require multiple rounds of voting until one candidate receives more than half the votes. Some actions that limit members' rights require a two-thirds vote, such as closing debate or suspending rules. This higher threshold protects minority voices from being silenced by a simple majority. In calculating two-thirds votes, nothing less than two-thirds will suffice. No rounding is permitted. For routine matters with no apparent opposition, the chair can use unanimous consent to save time. Instead of formally voting, the chair asks, "Is there any objection to?" and pauses. If no one objects, the action is approved. If anyone objects, the chair must process the matter through formal voting procedures. Every member has the right to vote unless formally suspended through disciplinary action. While you shouldn't vote on matters where you have a direct, personal, or financial interest not shared by other members, you cannot be forced to abstain due to such conflicts. To maintain impartiality, the chair normally doesn't debate issues and votes only in two circumstances: when voting by ballot or when the chair's vote would change the outcome. In a tie vote on a majority-required motion, the chair may vote in favor to break the tie. If a motion is passing by just one vote, the chair may vote against it to create a tie, causing the motion to fail. Various voting methods serve different purposes. Voice votes, I know, are quick and common for routine matters. Standing votes, or show of hands, provide visual confirmation when results might be close. Counted votes become necessary when exact numbers matter or when required by members. Ballot votes ensure privacy for elections and sensitive decisions. Understanding these voting methods and requirements helps ensure that decisions accurately reflect the group's will, while protecting minority rights and maintaining efficient operations. The varying thresholds for different types of actions reflect parliamentary procedure's balance between majority rule and minority protection, fundamental principles that sustain democratic governance. Effective organizations require both skilled leadership and accurate documentation. The roles of president, secretary, and treasurer form the backbone of most organizational structures, each with specific responsibilities that ensure smooth operations and institutional memory. The president's primary responsibility is presiding over meetings effectively. This requires mastering key procedures, recognizing members to speak, handling motions properly, conducting votes, and maintaining order. A skilled presiding officer ensures all members understand what's being debated and voted on, repeating motion wording frequently and explaining amendments clearly. Though this repetition might seem excessive, it's far better to risk taxing patience by repeating motion wording than to risk taking a vote whose effect is unclear to members. The secretary serves as the organization's institutional memory, keeping official records and preparing accurate minutes. Contrary to common practice, minutes should record only what was done, not what was said. They should include the kind of meeting, organization name, date, time, place, presence of required officers, whether previous minutes were approved, all main motions with their disposition, counted votes, notices, points of order with rulings, and adjournment time. Detailed summaries of reports or debates don't belong in minutes. The treasurer manages the organization's funds, spending only as authorized by the society or bylaws. At regular meetings, a simple statement of the cash balance may suffice, but an annual financial report must be submitted for audit. This audit process, whether conducted by professional accountants or an internal committee, provides accountability and protects both the organization and the treasurer. Boards and committees operate with somewhat different procedures than general membership meetings. Small boards, under 12 members, and committees typically use more informal procedures. Members may remain seated while speaking, motions need no seconds, members may speak multiple times on a question, and the chair can debate and vote while presiding. However, regardless of size, valid action requires proper notice to all members and a quorum at a properly called meeting. These leadership roles and documentation practices might seem mundane compared to an organization's substantive work, but they provide the infrastructure that makes that work possible. Well-run meetings, accurate records, and proper financial management create the stability and transparency that allow organizations to pursue their missions effectively over time.